and in the kitchen Frau Elena holds her flower-whitened hands in the air and cocks her head, studying Werner, and two older boys rush in and stop, sensing some change in the air, and the little radio with its four terminals and trailing aerial sits motionless on the floor between them all, like a miracle. Take us home. Usually, Marie-Laure can solve the wooden puzzle boxes her father creates for her birthdays. Often they are shaped like houses and contain some hidden trinket. Opening them involves a cunning series of steps. Find a seam with your fingernails, slide the bottom to the right, detach a side rail, remove a hidden key from inside the rail, unlock the top, and discover a bracelet inside. For her 7th birthday, a tiny wooden chalet stands in the center of the kitchen table where the sugar bowl ought to be. She slides a hidden drawer out of the base, finds a hidden compartment beneath the drawer, takes out a wooden key, and slots the key inside the chimney. Inside waits a square of Swiss chocolate. 4 minutes, says her father, laughing. I'll have to work harder next year. For a long time, though, unlike his puzzle boxes, the model of their neighborhood makes little sense to her. It is not like the real world. The miniature intersection of Rue de Mirbel and Rue Monge, for example, just a block from their apartment, is nothing like the real intersection. The real one presents an amphitheater of noise and fragrance. In the fall, it smells of traffic and castor oil, bread from the bakery, camphor from Avant's pharmacy, delphiniums and sweet peas and roses from the flower stand. On winter days, it swims with the odor of roasting chestnuts. On summer evenings, it becomes slow and drowsy, full of sleepy conversations and the scraping of heavy iron chairs. But her father's model of the same intersection smells only of dried glue and sawdust. Its streets are empty, its pavements static. To her fingers, it serves as little more than a tiny and insufficient facsimile. He persists in asking Marie-Laure to run her fingers over it, to recognize different houses, the angles of streets. And one cold Tuesday in December, when Marie-Laure has been blind for over a year, her father walks her up to Rue Cuvier, to the edge of the Jardin des Plantes. Here, ma chérie, is the path we take every morning. Through the cedars up ahead is the Grand Gallery.
I know, Papa.
He picks her up and spins her around 3 times. Now, he says, you're going to take us home. Her mouth drops open. I want you to think of the model, Marie.
But I can't possibly.
I'm 1 step behind you. I won't let anything happen. You have your cane. You know where you are.
I do not.
You do. Exasperation. She cannot even say if the gardens are ahead or behind. Calm yourself, Marie. 1 centimeter at a time.
It's far, Papa. 6 blocks at least.
6 blocks is exactly right. Use logic. Which way should we go first? The world pivots and rumbles. Crows shout. Brakes hiss. Someone to her left bangs something metal with what might be a hammer. She shuffles forward until the tip of her cane floats in space. The edge of a curb? A pond? A staircase? A cliff? She turns 90 degrees. 3 steps forward. Now her cane finds the base of a wall.
Papa?
I'm here. 6 paces, 7 paces, 8. A roar of noise. An exterminator just leaving a house, pump bellowing, overtakes them. 12 paces farther on, the bell tied around the handle of a shop door rings, and 2 women come out, jostling her as they pass. Marie-Laure drops her cane. She begins to cry. Her father lifts her, holds her to his narrow chest.
It's so big,
she whispers. You can do this, Mari. She cannot. Something rising. While the other children play hopscotch in the alley or swim in the canal, Werner sits alone in his upstairs dormer experimenting with the radio receiver. In a week, he can dismantle and rebuild it with his eyes closed. Capacitor, inductor, tuning coil, earpiece. One wire goes to ground, the other to sky. Nothing he's encountered before has made so much sense. He harvests parts from supply sheds. Snips of copper wire, screws, a bent screwdriver. He charms the druggist's wife into giving him a broken earphone. He salvages a solenoid from a discarded doorbell, solders it to a resistor, and makes a loudspeaker. Within a month, he manages to redesign the receiver entirely, adding new parts here and there and connecting it to a power source. Every evening, he carries his radio downstairs, and Frau Elena lets her wards listen for an hour. They tune into newscasts, concerts, operas, national choirs, folk shows, a dozen children in a semicircle on the furniture, Frau Elena among them, hardly more substantial than a child herself. We live in exciting times, says the radio. We make no complaints. We will plant our feet firmly in our earth, and no attack will ever move us. The older girls like musical competitions, radio gymnastics, a regular spot called Seasonal Tips for Those in Love that make the younger children squeal. The boys like plays, news bulletins, martial anthems. Jutta likes jazz. Werner likes everything. Violins, horns, drums, speeches, a mouth against a microphone in some faraway yet simultaneous evening. The sorcery of it holds him rapt. Is it any wonder, asks the radio, that courage, confidence, and optimism in growing measure fill the German people? Is not the flame of a new faith rising from the sacrificial readiness? Indeed, it does seem to Werner, as the weeks go by, that something new is rising. Mine production increases. Unemployment drops. Meat appears at Sunday supper. Lamb, pork, wieners, extravagances unheard of a year before. Frau Elena buys a new couch upholstered in orange corduroy, and a range with burners in black rings. Three new Bibles arrive from the consistory in Berlin. A laundry boiler is delivered to the back door. Werner gets new trousers. Jutta gets her own pair of shoes. Working telephones ring in the houses of neighbors. One afternoon, on the walk home from school, Werner stops outside the drugstore and presses his nose to a tall window. 5-dozen-inch-tall stormtroopers march there, each toy man with a brown shirt and a tiny red armband, some with flutes, some with drums, a few officers astride glossy black stallions. Above them, suspended from a wire, a tinplate clockwork aquaplane with wooden pontoons and a rotating propeller makes an electric, hypnotizing orbit. Werner studies it through the glass for a long time, trying to understand how it works. Night falls. Autumn in 1936, and Werner carries the radio downstairs and sets it on the sideboard, and the other children fidget in anticipation. The receiver hums as it warms. Werner steps back, hands in pockets. From the loudspeaker, a children's choir sings. We hope only to work and work and work, to go to glorious work for the country. Then a state-sponsored play out of Berlin begins. A story of invaders sneaking into a village at night. All 12 children sit riveted. In the play, the invaders pose as hook-nosed department store owners, crooked jewelers, dishonorable bankers. They sell glittering trash. They drive established village businessmen out of work. Soon they plot to murder German children in their beds. Eventually, a vigilant and humble neighbor catches on. Police are called. Big, handsome-sounding policemen with splendid voices. They break down the doors. They drag the invaders away. A patriotic march plays. Everyone is happy again. Light. Tuesday after Tuesday, she fails. She leads her father on six-block detours that leave her angry and frustrated, and farther from home than when they started. But in the winter of her eighth year, to Marie-Laure's surprise, she begins to get it right. She runs her fingers over the model in their kitchen, counting miniature benches, trees, lampposts, doorways. Every day some new detail emerges. Each storm drain, park bench, and hydrant in the model has its counterpart in the real world. Marie-Laure brings her father closer to home before making a mistake. 4 blocks. 3 blocks. 2. And one snowy Tuesday in March, when he walks her to yet another new spot very close to the banks of the Seine, spins her around 3 times and says, "Take us home." She realizes that, for the first time since they began this exercise, dread has not come trundling up from her gut. Instead, she squats on her heels on the sidewalk. The faintly metallic smell of the falling snow surrounds her. "Calm yourself. Listen." Cars splash along the street, and snowmelt drums through the runnels. She can hear snowflakes tick and patter through the trees. She can smell the cedars in the Jardin des Plantes, a quarter mile away. Here, the metro hurtles beneath the sidewalk. That's the Quai Saint Bernard. Here the sky opens up and she hears the clacking of branches. That's the narrow stripe of gardens behind the Gallery of Paleontology. This, she realizes, must be the corner of the Quai and the Rue Cuvier. 6 blocks. 40 buildings, 10 tiny trees in a square. This street intersects this street, 1 centimeter at a time. Her father stirs the keys in his pockets. Ahead loom the tall, grand houses that flank the gardens reflecting sound. She says, "We go left." They start up the length of the Rue Cuvier. A trio of airborne ducks threads toward them, flapping their wings in synchrony, making for the Seine. And as the birds rush overhead, she imagines she can feel the light settling over their wings, striking each individual feather. Left on Rue Linné. Right on Rue Daubenton. 3 storm drains, 4 storm drains, 5. Approaching on the left will be the open ironwork fence of the Jardin des Plantes, its thin spars like the bars of a great birdcage. Across from her now, the bakery, the butcher, the delicatessen. "Safe to cross, Papa?" "It is." "Right, then straight." They walk up their street now, she is sure of it. 1 step behind her, her father tilts his head up and gives the sky a huge smile. Marie-Laure knows this even though her back is to him. Even though he says nothing, even though she is blind. Papa's thick hair is wet from the snow and standing in 12 angles off his head, and his scarf is draped asymmetrically over his shoulders, and he's beaming up at the falling snow. They are halfway up the Rue des Patriarches. They are outside their building. Marie-Laure finds the trunk of the chestnut tree that grows past her 3rd-floor window, its bark beneath her fingers. Old friend. In another half-second, her father's hands are in her armpits, swinging her up, and Marie-Laure smiles, and he laughs a pure, contagious laugh, one she will try to remember all her life, father and daughter, turning in circles on the sidewalk in front of their apartment house, laughing together while snow sifts through the branches above. Our flag flutters before us. In Solverein, in the spring of Werner's 10th year, the 2 oldest boys at Children's House, 13-year-old Hans Schiltzer and 14-year-old Heribert Pomsel, shoulder second-hand knapsacks and goose-step into the woods. When they come back, they are members of the Hitler Youth. They carry slingshots, fashion spears, rehearse ambushes from behind snowbanks. They join a bristling gang of miners' sons who sit in the market square, sleeves rolled up, shorts hiked to their hips. "Good evening," they cry at passers-by. Or, "Heil Hitler," if you prefer. They give each other matching haircuts and wrestle in the parlor, and brag about the rifle training they're preparing for, the gliders they'll fly, the tank turrets they'll operate. "Our flag represents the new era," chant Hans and Heribert. "Our flag leads us to eternity." At meals, they chide younger children for admiring anything foreign. A British car advertisement. A French picture book. Their salutes are comical. Their outfits verge on ridiculous. But Frau Elena watches the boys with wary eyes. Not so long ago, they were feral toddlers skulking in their cots and crying for their mothers. Now they've become adolescent thugs with split knuckles and postcards of the Führer folded into their shirt pockets. Frau Elena speaks French less and less frequently whenever Hans and Heribert are present. She finds herself conscious of her accent. The smallest glance from a neighbor can make her wonder. Werner keeps his head down, leaping over bonfires, rubbing ash beneath your eyes, picking on little kids, crumpling Jutta's drawings? Far better, he decides, to keep one's presence small, inconspicuous. Werner has been reading the popular science magazines in the drugstore. He's interested in wave turbulence, tunnels to the center of the earth, the Nigerian method of relaying news over distances with drums. He buys a notebook and draws up plans for cloud chambers, ion detectors, X-ray goggles. What about a little motor attached to the cradles to rock the babies to sleep? How about springs stretched along the axles of his wagon to help him pull it up hills? An official from the labor ministry visits Children's House to speak about work opportunities at the mines. The children sit at his feet in their cleanest clothes. "All boys, without exception," explains the man, "will go to work for the mines once they turn 15. He speaks of glories and triumphs and how fortunate they'll be to have fixed employment. When he picks up Werner's radio and sets it back down without commenting, Werner feels the ceiling slip lower, the walls constrict. His father down there, a mile beneath the house, body never recovered, haunting the tunnels still. "From your neighborhood," the official says, "from your soil, comes the might of our nation. Steel, coal, coke. Berlin, Frankfurt, Munich. They do not exist without this place. You supply the foundation of the new order. The bullets in its guns, the armor on its tanks." Hans and Heribert examine the man's leather pistol belt with dazzled eyes. On the sideboard, Werner's little radio chatters. It says, "Over these 3 years, our leader has had the courage to face a Europe that was in danger of collapse." It says, "He alone is to be thanked for the fact that, for German children, a German life has once again become worth living." Around the World in 80 Days. 16 paces to the water fountain. 16 back. 42 to the stairwell, 42 back. Marie-Laure draws maps in her head, unreels 100 yards of imaginary twine, and then turns and reels it back in. Botany smells like glue and blotter paper and pressed flowers. Paleontology smells like rock dust, bone dust. Biology smells like formalin and old fruit. It is loaded with heavy, cool jars in which float things she has only had described for her. The pale, coiled ropes of rattlesnakes. The severed hands of gorillas. Entomology smells like mothballs and oil, a preservative that, Dr. Geffard explains, is called naphthalene. Offices smell of carbon paper or cigar smoke or brandy or perfume. or all four. She follows cables and pipes, railings and ropes, hedges and sidewalks. She startles people. She never knows if the lights are on. The children she meets brim with questions. Does it hurt? Do you shut your eyes to sleep? How do you know what time it is? It doesn't hurt, she explains. And there is no darkness, not the kind they imagine. Everything is composed of webs and lattices and upheavals of sound and texture. She walks a circle around the grand gallery, navigating between squeaking floorboards. She hears feet tramp up and down museum staircases, a toddler squeal, the groan of a weary grandmother lowering herself onto a bench. Color. That's another thing people don't expect. In her imagination, in her dreams, everything has color. The museum buildings are beige, chestnut, hazel. Its scientists are lilac and lemon yellow and fox brown. Piano chords loll in the speakers of the wireless in the guard station, projecting rich blacks and complicated blues down the hall toward the key pound. Church bells send arcs of bronze careening off the windows. Bees are silver, pigeons are ginger and auburn, and occasionally golden. The huge cypress trees she and her father pass on their morning walk are shimmering kaleidoscopes, each needle a polygon of light. She has no memories of her mother, but imagines her as white, a soundless brilliance. Her father radiates a thousand colors. Opal, strawberry red, deep russet, wild green, a smell like oil and metal, the feel of a lock tumbler sliding home, the sound of his key rings chiming as he walks. He is an olive green when he talks to a department head, an escalating series of oranges when he speaks to Mademoiselle Fleury from the greenhouses, a bright red when he tries to cook. He glows sapphire when he sits over his workbench in the evenings, humming almost inaudibly as he works, the tip of his cigarette gleaming a prismatic blue. She gets lost. Secretaries are botanists, and once the director's assistant, bringing her back to the key pound. She is curious. She wants to know the difference between an alga and a lichen, a Diplodon caruanus and a Diplodon delodontus. Famous men take her by the elbow and escort her through the gardens or guide her up stairwells. "I have a daughter, too," they'll say. Or, "I found her among the hummingbirds." "Toutes mes excuses," her father says. He lights a cigarette. He plucks key after key out of her pockets. "What," he whispers, "am I going to do with you?" On her 9th birthday, when she wakes, she finds 2 gifts. The first is a wooden box with no opening she can detect. She turns it this way and that. It takes her a little while to realize one side is spring-loaded. She presses it and the box flips open. Inside waits a single cube of creamy camembert that she pops directly into her mouth. "Too easy," her father says, laughing. The second gift is heavy, wrapped in paper and twine. Inside is a massive spiral-bound book, in Braille. "They said it's for boys, or very adventurous girls." She can hear him smiling. She slides her fingertips across the embossed title page. "Around the world in 80 days. Papa, it's too expensive." "That's for me to worry about." That morning, Marie-Laure crawls beneath the counter of the key pound and lies on her stomach and sets all 10 fingertips in a line on a page. The French feels old-fashioned, the dots printed much closer together than she is used to. But after a week, it becomes easy. She finds the ribbon she uses as a bookmark, opens the book, and the museum falls away. Mysterious Mr. Fogg lives his life like a machine, Jean Passepartout becomes his obedient valet. When, after 2 months, she reaches the novel's last line, she flips back to the first page and starts again. At night, she runs her fingertips over her father's model. The bell tower, the display windows. She imagines Jules Verne's characters walking along the streets, chatting in shops. A half-inch-tall baker slides speck-sized loaves in and out of his ovens. 3 minuscule burglars hatch plans as they drive slowly past the jewelers. Little grumbling cars throng the Rue de Mirbel, wipers sliding back and forth. Behind a fourth-floor window on the Rue des Patriarches, a miniature version of her father sits at a miniature workbench in their miniature apartment, just as he does in real life, sanding away at some infinitesimal piece of wood. Across the room is a miniature girl, skinny, quick-witted, an open book in her lap. Inside her chest pulses something huge, something full of longing, something unafraid. The Professor. "You have to swear," Yuta says. "Do you swear?" Amid rusted drums and shredded inner tubes and wormy creek-bottom muck, she has discovered 10 yards of copper wire. Her eyes are bright tunnels. Werner glances at the trees, the creek, back to his sister. "I swear." Together they smuggle the wire home and loop it back and forth through nail holes in the eave outside the attic window. Then they attach it to their radio. Almost immediately, on a shortwave band, they can hear someone talking in a strange language full of Z's and S's. Is it Russian? Werner thinks it's Hungarian. Jutta is all eyes in the dimness and heat. How far away is Hungary? 1,000 kilometers? She gapes. Voices, it turns out, streak into Zollverein from all over the continent, through the clouds, the coal dust, the roof. The air swarms with them. Jutta makes a log to match a scale that Werner draws on the tuning coil, carefully spelling the name of each city they manage to receive. Verona, 65. Dresden, 88. London, 100. Rome, Paris. Lyon. Late-night shortwave. Province of ramblers and dreamers. Madmen and ranters. After prayers, after lights out, Jutta sneaks up to her brother's dormer. Instead of drawing together, they lie hip to hip, listening till midnight, till 1, till 2. They hear British news reports they cannot understand. They hear a Berlin woman pontificating about the proper makeup for a cocktail party. One night, Werner and Jutta tune in to a scratchy broadcast in which a young man is talking in feathery, accented French about light. "The brain is locked in total darkness, of course, children," says the voice. "It floats in a clear liquid inside the skull, never in the light. And yet the world it constructs in the mind is full of light. It brims with color and movement. So how, children, does the brain, which lives without a spark of light, build for us a world full of light?" The broadcast hisses and pops. "What is this?" whispers Jutta. Werner does not answer. The Frenchman's voice is velvet. His accent is very different from Frau Elena's. Yet his voice is so ardent, so hypnotizing, that Werner finds he can understand every word. The Frenchman talks about optical illusions, electromagnetism. There's a pause, an peal of static, as though a record is being flipped, and then he enthuses about coal. "Consider a single piece glowing in your family's stove. See it, children. That chunk of coal was once a green plant, a fern or a reed that lived 1 million years ago, or maybe 2 million, or maybe 100 million. Can you imagine 100 million years? Every summer, for the whole life of that plant, Its leaves caught what light they could and transformed the sun's energy into itself, into bark, twigs, stems. Because plants eat light in much the way we eat food. But then the plant died and fell, probably into water, and decayed into peat. And the peat was folded inside the earth for years upon years, eons in which something like a month or a decade or even your whole life was just a puff of air, a snap of two fingers. And eventually, the peat dried and became like a stone, and someone dug it up. And the coal man brought it to your house, and maybe you yourself carried it to the stove, and now that sunlight, sunlight 100 million years old, is heating your home tonight. Time slows. The attic disappears. Yuta disappears. Has anyone ever spoken so intimately about the very things Werner is most curious about? Open your eyes, concludes the man, and see what you can with them before they close forever. And then a piano comes on, playing a lonely song that sounds to Werner like a golden boat traveling a dark river, a progression of harmonies that transfigures Solverein. The houses turned to mist, the mines filled in, the smokestacks fallen, an ancient sea spilling through the streets, and the air streaming with possibility. Sea of Flames. Rumors circulate through the Paris Museum, moving fast as quickly as brightly colored scarves. The museum is considering displaying a certain gemstone, a jewel more valuable than anything else in all the collections. Word has it, Marie Laure overhears one taxidermist telling another, the stone is from Japan. It's very ancient. It belonged to a shogun in the 11th century. I hear, the other says, it came out of our own vaults, that it's been here all along, but for some legal reason we weren't allowed to show it. One day it's a cluster of rare magnesium hydroxycarbonate. The next, it's a star sapphire that will set a man's hand on fire if he touches it. Then it becomes a diamond, definitely a diamond. Some people call it the Shepherd's Stone. Others call it Conma. But soon enough, everyone is calling it the Sea of Flames. Marie Laure thinks. 4 years have passed. Evil, says a warder in the guard station. Brings sorrow on anyone who carries it. I heard all 9 previous owners have committed suicide. A second voice says, I heard that anyone who holds it in his ungloved hand dies within a week. No, no, if you hold it, you cannot die, but the people around you die within a month. Or maybe it's a year. I better get my hands on that, says a third, laughing. Marie Laure's heart races. 10 years old, and onto the black screen of her imagination, she can project anything. A sailing yacht. A sword battle. A coliseum seething with color. She has read Around the World in 80 Days until the braille is soft and fraying. For this year's birthday, her father has bought her an even fatter book. Dumas' The 3 Musketeers. Marie Laure hears that the diamond is pale green and as big as a coat button. Then she hears it's as big as a matchbook. A day later, it's blue and as big as a baby's fist. She envisions an angry goddess stalking the halls, sending curses through the galleries like poison clouds. Her father says to tamp down her imagination. Stones are just stones, and rain is just rain, and misfortune is just bad luck. Some things are simply more rare than others, and that's why there are locks. But, Papa, do you believe it's real? The diamond or the curse? Both. Either. They're just stories, Murray. and yet whenever anything goes wrong, the staff whispers that the diamond has caused it. The electricity fails for an hour. It's the diamond. A leaky pipe destroys an entire rack of pressed botanical samples. It's the diamond. When the director's wife slips on ice in the Place des Vosges and breaks her wrist in two places, the museum's gossip machine explodes. Around this time, Marie-Laure's father is summoned upstairs to the director's office. He's been there for 2 hours. When else in her memory has her father been called to the director's office for a 2-hour meeting? Not once. Almost immediately afterward, her father begins working deep within the Gallery of Mineralogy. For weeks, he wheels carts loaded with various pieces of equipment in and out of the keypound, working long after the museum has closed. And every night he returns to the keypound smelling of brazing alloy and sawdust. Each time she asks to accompany him, he demurs. It would be best, he says, if she stayed in the keypound with her braille workbooks or upstairs in the mollusk laboratory. She pesters him at breakfast. You're building a special case to display that diamond. Some kind of transparent safe. Her father lights a cigarette. Please get your book, Murray. Time to go. Dr. Geffard's answers are hardly better. You know how diamonds, how all crystals grow, Laurette? By adding microscopic layers, a few thousand atoms every month, each atop the next. Millennia after millennia. That's how stories accumulate, too. All the old stones accumulate stories. That little rock you're so curious about may have seen Alaric sack Rome. It may have glittered in the eyes of pharaohs. Scythian queens might have danced all night wearing it. Wars might have been fought over it. Papa says curses are only stories cooked up to deter thieves. He says there are 65 million specimens in this place, and that if you have the right teacher, each can be as interesting as the last. Still, he says, certain things compel people. Pearls, for example, and sinistral shells, shells with a left-handed opening. Even the best scientists feel the urge now and then to put something in a pocket. That something so small could be so beautiful, worth so much. Only the strongest people can turn away from feelings like that. They're quiet a moment. Marie-Laure says, I heard that the diamond is like a piece of light from the original world. Before it fell, a piece of light rained to earth from God. You want to know what it looks like? That's why you're so curious. She rolls a Murex in her hands, holds it to her ear. 10,000 drawers, 10,000 whispers inside 10,000 shells. No, she says. I want to believe that Papa hasn't been anywhere near it. Open your eyes. Werner and Jutta find the Frenchman's broadcasts again and again. Always around bedtime, always midway through some increasingly familiar script. Today, let's consider the whirling machinery, children, that must engage inside your head for you to scratch your eyebrow. They hear a program about sea creatures, another about the North Pole. Jutta likes one on magnets. Werner's favorite is one about light. Eclipses and sundials, auroras and wavelengths. What do we call visible light? We call it color, but the electromagnetic spectrum runs to zero in one direction and infinity in the other. So really, children, mathematically, all of light is invisible. Werner likes to crouch in his dormer and imagine radio waves like mile-long harp strings bending and vibrating over Zollverein, flying through forests, through cities, through walls. At midnight, he and Jutta prowl the ionosphere, searching for that lavish, penetrating voice. When they find it, Werner feels that he has been launched into a different existence. a secret place where great discoveries are possible, where an orphan from a coal town can solve some vital mystery hidden in the physical world. He and his sister mimic the Frenchman's experiments. They make speedboats out of matchsticks and magnets out of sewing needles.
Why doesn't he say where he is, Ferner?
Maybe because he doesn't want us to know.
He sounds rich and lonely. I bet he does these broadcasts from a huge mansion, big as this whole colony, a house with 1,000 rooms and 1,000 servants.
Ferner smiles. Could be. The voice, the piano again. Perhaps it's Ferner's imagination, but each time he hears one of the programs, the quality seems to degrade a bit more. The sound growing fainter, as though the Frenchman broadcasts from a ship that is slowly traveling farther away. As the weeks pass, with Jutta asleep beside him, Ferner looks out into the night sky, and restlessness surges through him. Life. It's happening beyond the mills, beyond the gates. Out there people chase questions of great importance. He imagines himself as a tall, white-coated engineer striding into a laboratory. Cauldrons steam. Machinery rumbles. Complex charts paper the walls. He carries a lantern up the winding staircase to a starlit observatory and looks through the eyepiece of a great telescope, its mouth pointed into the black. Fade. Maybe the old tour guide was off his rocker. Maybe the Sea of Flames never existed at all. Maybe curses aren't real. Maybe her father is right. Earth is all magma and continental crust and ocean, gravity and time. Stones are just stones, and rain is just rain, and misfortune is just bad luck. Her father returns to the key pound earlier in the evenings. Soon he is taking Marie-Laure along on various errands again, teasing her about the mountains of sugar she spoons into her coffee, or bantering with warders about the superiority of his brand of cigarettes. No dazzling new gemstone goes on exhibit. No plagues rain down upon museum employees. Marie-Laure does not succumb to a snake bite or tumble into a sewer and break her back. On the morning of her 11th birthday, she wakes to find 2 new packages where the sugar bowl should be. The first is a lacquered wooden cube constructed entirely from sliding panels. It takes 13 steps to open, and she discovers the sequence in under 5 minutes.
"Good Christ," says her father. "You're a safecracker."
Inside the cube, 2 Barnier bonbons. She unwraps both and puts them in her mouth at the same time. Inside the second package, a fat stack of pages with Braille on the cover. 20,000 leagues under the sea. The bookseller said it's in 2 parts, and this is the first. I thought that next year, if we keep saving, we can get the second. She begins that instant. The narrator, a famed marine biologist named Pierre Aronnax, works at the same museum as her father. Around the world, he learns, ships are being rammed one after another. After a scientific expedition to America, Aronnax ruminates over the true nature of the incidents. Are they caused by a moving reef? A gigantic horned narwhal? A mythical kraken? But I am letting myself be carried away by reveries which I must now put aside, writes Aronnax. Enough of these fantasies. All day long, Marie-Laure lies on her stomach and reads. Logic, reason, pure science. These, Aronnax insists, are the proper ways to pursue a mystery. Not fables and fairy tales. Her fingers walk the tight ropes of sentences. In her imagination, she walks the decks of the speedy 2-funneled frigate called the Abraham Lincoln. She watches New York City recede. The forts of New Jersey salute her departure with cannons. Channel markers bob in the swells. A lightship with twin beacons glides past as America recedes. Ahead wait the great glittering prairies of the Atlantic. The Principles of Mechanics. A vice minister and his wife visit Children's House. Frau Elena says they are touring orphanages. Everyone washes, everyone behaves. Maybe, the children whisper, they are considering adopting. The oldest girls serve pumpernickel and goose liver on the house's last unchipped plates, while the portly vice minister and his severe-looking wife inspect the parlor like lords come to tour some distasteful gnomish cottage. When supper is ready, Werner sits at the boys' end of the table with a book in his lap. Jutta sits with the girls at the opposite end, her hair frizzed and snarled and bright white, so it looks as if she's been electrified. Bless us, O Lord, and these thy gifts. Frau Elena adds a second prayer for the vice minister's benefit. Everyone falls to eating. The children are nervous. Even Hans Schiltzer and Heribert Pomsel sit quietly in their brown shirts. The vice minister's wife sits so upright that it seems as if her spine is hewn from oak. Her husband says, "And each of the children contributes?" "Certainly. Claudia, for instance, made the bread basket, and the twins prepared the livers." Big Claudia Förster blushes. The twins bat their eyelashes. Werner's mind drifts. He is thinking about the book in his lap, The Principles of Mechanics by Heinrich Hertz. He discovered it in the church basement, water-stained and forgotten, decades old, and the rector let him bring it home, and Frau Elena let him keep it. And for several weeks, Werner has been fighting through the thorny mathematics. Electricity, Werner is learning, can be static by itself. But couple it with magnetism, and suddenly you have movement. Waves, fields and circuits, conduction and induction, space, time, mass. The air swarms with so much that is invisible. How he wishes he had eyes to see the ultraviolet, eyes to see the infrared, eyes to see radio waves crowding the darkening sky, flashing through the walls of the house. When he looks up, everyone is staring at him. Frau Elena's eyes are alarmed. "It's a book, sir," announces Hans Schiltzer. He tugs it out of Werner's lap. The volume is heavy enough that he needs both hands to hold it up. Several creases sharpen in the forehead of the vice minister's wife. Werner can feel his cheeks flush. The vice minister extends a pudgy hand. "Give it here." "Is it a Jew book?" says Heribert Pomsel. "It's a Jew book, isn't it?" Frau Elena looks as if she's about to speak, then thinks better of it. "Hertz was born in Hamburg," says Werner. Jutta announces out of nowhere, "My brother is so quick at mathematics, he's quicker than every one of the schoolmasters. Someday he'll probably win a big prize. He says we'll go to Berlin and study under the great scientists." The younger children gape. The oldest children snicker. Werner stares hard into his plate. The vice minister frowns as he turns pages. Hans Schiltzer kicks Werner in the shin and coughs. Frau Elena says, "Jutta, that's enough." The vice minister's wife takes a forkful of liver and chews and swallows and touches her napkin to each corner of her mouth. The vice minister sets down the Principles of Mechanics and pushes it away, then glances at his palms as though it has made them dirty. He says, "The only place your brother is going, little girl, is into the mines, as soon as he turns 15, same as every other boy in this house." Jutta scowls, and Werner stares at the congealed liver on his plate with his eyes burning and something inside his chest compressing tighter and tighter, and for the rest of the supper the only sound is of the children cutting and chewing and swallowing. Rumors. new rumors arrive. They rustle along the paths of the Jardin des Plantes and wind through the museum galleries. They echo in high, dusty redoubts, where shriveled old botanists study exotic mosses. They say the Germans are coming. The Germans, a gardener claims, have 60,000 troop gliders. They can march for days without eating. They impregnate every schoolgirl they meet. A woman behind the ticket counter says the Germans carry fog pills and wear rocket belts. Their uniforms, she whispers, are made of a special cloth stronger than steel. Marie-Laure sits on a bench beside the mollusk display and trains her ears on passing groups. A boy blurts, "They have a bomb called the Secret Signal. It makes a sound, and everyone who hears it goes to the bathroom in their pants." Laughter. "I hear they give out poison chocolate. I hear they lock up the cripples and morons everywhere they go." Each time Marie-Laure relays another rumor to her father, he repeats, "Germany?" with a question mark after it, as if saying it for the very first time. He says the takeover of Austria is nothing to worry about. He says everyone remembers the last war, and no one is mad enough to go through that again. The director is not worrying, he says, and neither are the department heads, so neither should young girls who have lessons to learn. It seems true. Nothing changes but the day of the week. Every morning, Marie-Laure wakes and dresses, and follows her father through entrance number 2 and listens to him greet the night guard and the warder. "Bonjour, bonjour, bonjour, bonjour." The scientists and librarians still collect their keys in the mornings, still study their ancient elephant's teeth, their exotic jellyfish, their herbarium sheets. The secretaries still talk about fashion. The director still arrives in a 2-tone Delage limousine. And every noon, the African vendors still wheel their sandwich carts quietly down the halls with their whispers of rye and egg, rye and egg. Marie-Laure reads Jules Verne in the key pound, on the toilet, in the corridors. She reads along the benches of the Grand Gallery and out along the 100 gravel paths of the garden. She reads the first half of 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea so many times she practically memorizes it. "The sea is everything. It covers 7/10 of the globe. The sea is only a receptacle for all the prodigious, supernatural things that exist inside it. It is only movement and love. It is the living infinite." At night, in her bed, she rides in the belly of Captain Nemo's Nautilus, below the gales while canopies of coral drift overhead. Dr. Giffard teaches her the names of the shells. Lambus lambus, Cypraea moneta, Lophiatoma acuta, and lets her feel the spines and apertures and whorls of each in turn. He explains the branches of marine evolution and the sequences of the geological periods. On her best days, she glimpses the limitless span of millennia behind her. Millions of years. Tens of millions. "Nearly every species that has ever lived has gone extinct, Lorette. No reason to think we humans will be any different." Dr. Geffard pronounces this almost gleefully and pours wine into his glass, and she imagines his head as a cabinet filled with 10,000 little drawers. All summer the smells of nettles and daisies and rainwater purl through the gardens. She and her father cook a pear tart and burn it by accident, and her father opens all the windows to let out the smoke, and she hears violin music rise from the street below. And yet by early autumn, once or twice a week, at certain moments of the day, sitting out in the Jardin des Plantes beneath the massive hedges or reading beside her father's workbench, Marie-Laure looks up from her book and believes she can smell gasoline under the wind, as if a great river of machinery is steaming slowly, irrevocably toward her. Bigger, faster, brighter. Membership in the state youth becomes mandatory. The boys in Werner's Kameradschaften are taught parade maneuvers and quizzed on fitness standards and required to run 60 meters in 12 seconds. Everything is glory and country and competition and sacrifice. Live faithfully, the boys sing as they troop past the edges of the colony. Fight bravely and die laughing. Schoolwork, chores, exercises. Werner stays up late listening to his radio or driving himself through the complicated math he copied out of the Principles of Mechanics before it was confiscated. He yawns at meals, is short-tempered with the other children. "Are you feeling okay?" asks Frau Elena, peering into his face. And Werner looks away, saying, "Fine." Hertz's theories are interesting, but what he loves most is building things, working with his hands, connecting his fingers to the engine of his mind. Werner repairs a neighbor's sewing machine, the children's house grandfather clock. He builds a pulley system to wind laundry from the sunshine back indoors, and a simple alarm made from a battery, a bell, and wires so that Frau Elena will know if a toddler has wandered outside. He invents a machine to slice carrots. Lift a lever, 19 blades drop, and the carrot falls apart into 20 neat cylinders. One day, a neighbor's wireless goes out, and Frau Elena suggests Werner have a look. He unscrews the back plate, waggles the tubes back and forth. One is not seated properly, and he fits it back into its groove. The radio comes back to life, and the neighbor shrieks with delight. Before long, people are stopping by the children's house every week to ask for the radio repairman. When they see 13-year-old Werner come down from the attic, rubbing his eyes, shocks of white hair sticking up off his head, homemade toolbox hanging from his fist, they stare at him with the same skeptical smirk. The older sets are the easiest to fix. Simpler circuitry, uniform tubes. Maybe it's wax dripping from the condenser or charcoal built up on the resistor. Even in the newest sets, Werner can usually puzzle out a solution. He dismantles the machine, stares into its circuits, lets his fingers trace the journeys of electrons. Power source, triode, resistor coil, loudspeaker. His mind shapes itself around the problem. Disorder becomes order. The obstacle reveals itself. And before long, the radio is fixed. Sometimes they pay him a few marks. Sometimes a coal mother cooks him sausages or wraps biscuits in a napkin to take home to his sister. Before long, Werner can draw a map in his head of the locations of nearly every radio in their district. A homemade crystal set in the kitchen of a druggist. A handsome 10-valve radiogram in the home of a department head that was giving his fingers a shock every time he tried to change the channel. Even the poorest pit houses usually possess a state-sponsored Volksempfänger, VE-301, a mass-produced radio stamped with an eagle and a swastika, incapable of shortwave, marked only for German frequencies. Radio. It ties a million ears to a single mouth. Out of loudspeakers all around Solferine, the staccato voice of the Reich grows like some imperturbable tree. Its subjects lean toward its branches as if toward the lips of God. And when God stops whispering, they become desperate for someone who can put things right. 7 days a week, the miners drag coal into the light. And the coal is pulverized and fed into coke ovens, and the coke is cooled in huge quenching towers and carted to the blast furnaces to melt iron ore, and the iron is refined into steel and cast into billets and loaded onto barges and floated off into the great hungry mouth of the country. "Only through the hottest fires," whispers the radio, "can purification be achieved. Only through the harshest test can God's chosen rise." Jutta whispers, "A girl got kicked out of the swimming hole today. Inga Hachmann. They said they wouldn't let us swim with a half-breed. Unsanitary." "A half-breed, Werner. Aren't we half-breeds, too? Aren't we half our mother, half our father?" "They mean half-Jew. Keep your voice down. We're not half-Jews." "We must be half-something." "We're whole German," were not half anything. Heribert Palmsell is 15 years old now, off in a miner's dormitory working the second shift as a fire damper, and Hans Schiltzer has become the oldest boy in the house. Hans